Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia Exceed plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Let's go straight to vaccines. That's all you're hearing about. We just hear from people about what's happening on the ground. John Owens. John, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe? How's
your mother was due to, she's 89, due to get the vaccine today. How did she get on?
Well, I'd love to have better news for you, Joe, but it didn't happen. So she was due to get it today. And this woman has been hibernating, I suppose, or shielding for the last, the guts of the last year. I'm playing by all the rules, and we've been managing her week to week, you know, and this week it's been day to day, you know, it's all about Thursday. And rang the GP surgery yesterday to get a time, only to be told they don't even have any vaccines yet. So that was devastating to her.
So Thursday, February 25, where did that come from?
That was the first date that we got from the GP as the date to call in to get the vaccine.
Okay, and another 2 weeks at the earliest. Is that it?
Yeah, so we were told yesterday that it won't be today, and the next likely date, not even guaranteed date, is the 10th of March. So as you can imagine, we had to pick my mother up off the floor yesterday with the news of that.
Okay, stay there, John. Mary, good afternoon. Joe at RT.ie. Mary, good afternoon. It's your mother. When was she due to get her vaccine, or what information has she got, Mary? She's 87.
Hi, Joe. Yeah. I'm actually surprised listening to that gentleman on the other line. I didn't think that there was any more than just the cohort of people that I was told about. My mom got her appointment on Friday from the clinic, which her GP is attached to. And the appointment was set up for today at noon.
Okay.
And yesterday at 3:30, we got a cancellation call. And the lady I spoke to told me she had 90 calls to make to cancel everybody for today. And she had another 90 to make to cancel for everybody for Friday.
For why? Why? Did it say why?
The vaccine wasn't delivered. And I said, well, what excuse do they give, or what did they say in relation to the next time? And they said, we haven't been told. And as soon as we are told, we'll be back in touch with you.
So how many people, insofar as you know, Mary, how many people were due to get the vaccine in that clinic today or that area?
90 today.
And all 90 have been told don't come, don't arrive.
That's right.
And have any of them, insofar as you know, an alternative date?
No.
Okay. Now, what was when people heard, which was to be, there've been so many messages, I thought all 85-year-olds were going to be done within the next week or two.
But Joe, to be quite honest with you, to pick up the phone and tell any over 85 person that they are going to get the vaccine lights up their life, and they count the days, they count the hours.
Excitement,
to tell them at 3:30 the day before that they're not getting it, I mean, it just puts them into a place that the lockdown hadn't even put them into. But the most disrespectful part of it is, you know, listening to the news last night and being told that the next lot of people are being considered, and that just leaves all those old people going, what about me?
Yeah.
And 100%. But John, you know, when there was a strong argument that featured this programme, people with CF, for example, arguing, and in a very embracing way, they weren't looking for anyone to be bumped off the list, but arguing that they should, given their underlying condition, they should go up the list. Now, they have gone up to Category 4 as of Tuesday evening. But Mary or John, either of you, do you know if either of your relatives, who were over 85, have they been pushed down the list to make way for people that might be seen as in greater need?
I think it's next to impossible to find that out, Joe. It's really difficult to find out where the fault lies in the whole chain of command, from the HSE all the way to the GPs at the front. So maybe that happens. But it's impossible to know from where we're standing.
Okay, Mary, you haven't any indication that they were...
No, Joe, and the reason that I got in touch with your programme was simply because I made phone calls yesterday to the HSE. I spoke to 7 different people. I got the runaround. Everybody's passing the book to somebody else. Nobody is giving any indication as to why it happened or how it's going to be rectified. And I just think it's kind of ironic, and my suggestion was, you know, the HSE should listen to the ads that are on RTE that are being supported by gov.ie, because it said, let's do the right thing by each other. Well, this is not doing the right thing by the old people. You don't give them an appointment and take it away and leave them feeling worse than they have for 12 months. It's just cruel.
Katie Curley, 51551, watch your hands. Katie, what's your situation?
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good,
first of all, John and Mary, I'm so sorry to hear about your mothers. That's really tough. So we're a private healthcare practice in Dundalk, and we are occupational therapy and speech and language therapy. So we're categorised as frontline healthcare worker, category 2F. And we have not been able to get a vaccine or any appointment. So we were given the HSE vaccine portal a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. and it's been a dead end. And I have probably sent all to 100 emails between the 4th of January and this week to the HSE, to the Department of Health, to various politicians, and kind of going in circles a wee bit.
And have any of the clinicians got the vaccines?
I am a clinician.
Oh, you are? Sorry, okay.
Yeah, so there's 6 clinicians here
and
in
you,
this practice.
And you're, no, nobody has been jabbed?
None of my colleagues, no. So I know I'm not the only private
practitioner. And Katie, have you been told why?
No, nothing. We were also told at the beginning of this process that there would be no discrimination between private healthcare and the HSE. But that's clearly not the case, because most of my HSE colleagues have received their job, or even admin staff I'm hearing about that are not in face-to-face roles at all. And we're seeing up to like 220 people a week in our practice, face-to-face.
And Katie, why do you think it's, or do you think, sorry, shouldn't put words, do you think it's because you're a private clinic?
I don't know, to be honest. It's hard to not think that. It's hard to not feel discriminated against, but it could be an oversight. But again, I know there's been a lot of people in private practice lobbying the HSE and the government, and we're not getting a lot of information. Like, I received a link today from the Department of Health that I had received weeks ago. It's the same link.
And Katie, how have you managed then during the, given
it's
that you are
exhausting.
On the front line?
Yeah, it's been exhausting, Joe. Like, we wear PPE. We have installed mechanical air filtration systems in the clinic that cost a lot of money. We have really upped the infection control protocol. We've staggered time. We've done everything we can. And it's getting really tiresome. Also, in our personal life, we're not seeing family, we're not seeing friends. And that's really tiresome. That's been since June, when we reopened after our closing down. So, like, my last experience of meeting my parents was in Alfie. It was a chance meeting. I left in tears because I can't really see my parents.
And you bumped in, well, you bumped into them, so to speak, figuratively, in Aldi.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, and like that's a sacrifice in healthcare we are having to make.
Yeah.
And we have been making for months and months and months. And it's like we were thinking that we were getting light at the end of the tunnel with this vaccine, and all we've had is a disappointment.
And where do you stand on the priority list, Katie? What level are you?
Apparently we're in category 2F.
Yeah.
So the news yesterday said that all of category 2 had been done, but we're not.
By the way, have you been told you've been done?
No, I haven't.
No, okay. Is the computer telling you were done?
The computer's giving me a dead end.
Okay.
Like, it's bringing me nowhere. And again, I'm not the only private practice in this position. I think the majority of us are.
Okay. John Owen, did John want to come back in there, or Mary?
Yeah, I think it's just, I really sympathise with the clinician there. But
Thank you.
I said, I think it's probably my gut feel that it's a HSE delivery logistics issue. And they need to know that it's unacceptable to be late on this. It is absolutely crucial. Like, you can tell by the callers, the support that people have to put in for their elderly people and face-to-face and clinical settings, it's enormous. And it's not going to last much longer. So something it has to happen, and it has to be guaranteed to happen on the day it's given.
Okay. Katie, have your parents, I'm not presuming they're elderly, but are your, have your parents been given a vaccination date?
No, my parents are in their 60s.
In their 60s, so they're young.
Yeah.
In every
yeah.
sense of the word. So
yeah.
I don't know when will they be done? Well, we're told, Micheál Martin says everyone, the Taoiseach, sorry, says everyone will be done by, everyone in the risky categories. In other words, 98% of the demographic that have been hospitalised or indeed died from COVID, 98% of that demographic will be done by June.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? I would just like you to throw it out there to the HSE and ask them, you know, if they went to the bother of contacting the clinics to suggest that there was going to be vaccinations on Thursday and Friday of this week, and that call was obviously made to somebody last week. Can somebody actually own that? Can somebody stand up and say, well, I cancelled it for this reason and, you know, these people will be contacted? Like, they can't keep hiding behind receptionists who keep passing the book because they're not getting the information. Somebody has to own this problem.
And Mary, your receptionist told you she was going to have to make 90 calls.
90 calls, and she was dreading
it. To cancel. Can you imagine?
At 3:30. I mean, that's 90 old people, but that's probably 90 other people, you know, within their family that had to, you know, arrange cars and childminders and whatever to get their parent there on time. It was made quite clear that the elderly people, when they came in, that they were just going to be vaccinated, and please don't talk about pains in your back or pains in your knee. We're only dealing with the vaccinations. So that left empty clinics today. You know, doctors that had cleared their books to make all of this happen, twiddling their thumbs.
Well, that's another good point. Okay, John Owens, Katie Curley and Mary, thank you all. 51551 my chance, and joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
I know we don't want to give away too much information in terms of privacy, but I know one of our callers there before the break was Dublin 10. I'm trying to find out where the other caller was from. And Marion O'Brien, you're North Dublin, you're Balbriggan. What happened? Your father, 87, when was he due to get the vaccine?
Well, they're from Coolock. And he's 87 in September. And I phoned the GP and they were supposed to get the batch in yesterday or today. And I rang today to find out. And she, now to be fair to the receptionist, she was quite upset herself. She said they only got the call, say, Tuesday to say that it was going to a different GP, that they reckon, the HSC reckoned the other GP had more patients. And that she had to make all these phone calls. But what I was more upset about is, and I hope I don't go out there crying, is he's my mother's sole carer. She's Parkinson's. And she's 80 in August. And now that I have to tell them tomorrow that they've been told that she probably won't get the vaccine with him because she's not over 85. Yeah. And she's Parkinson's. But I'm the one, and I know everybody's in the same boat. I understand that, and I do believe that they're giving out the vaccines that come in. I don't think they're holding
of course,
them back. But I think they're giving us false hope. And as his daughter, I'm the one that goes in and looks after him because my other family live away from home. And it's a lot of pressure on me because I'm terrified I'll give it to them. So, you know, it's the pressure on us because the strain of us going in, and I'm honoured to look after my parents. I'm 57 and I'm lucky to have both of them and they're so good.
Yeah.
But it's the pressure on us going into them. You know what I mean? I'm terrified because I have a husband and a son that still work. And I'm lucky, I'm not saying I'm not, but and I still look at my dad. He's terrified that it'll come into the house. He's gone from a man that would walk and he still drives. He's a very fit man to being a prisoner in his own home. And this was his lifeline. I'm sorry. This was his lifeline. This was his thing. He thought, you know, and God love me, he thinks that my mum will get this vaccine and everything will be okay. Cause it won't because she's Parkinson's. But he thinks that, you know, to be able to go for walks. And it's just awful. And what's awful is I've had to chase up the vaccine for them. They haven't heard from the HSC at all. Nothing.
Yeah. Now, do you have something to say, Marion? Has your dad, who's 87, has he got a date? I know that.
He never even got a word from the HSC. But to be fair, the doctor rang him and said, look, you know, Mr. Bennett, you know, you are on our list. We're just waiting for it to come in. But he hasn't heard from anybody. I've been ringing everybody for him, and I have to tell him tomorrow that...
And your mother is younger, slightly.
She'll be 80 in August. Okay. But I have to tell him now that... And he won't get it without her. He won't get her without her because they just live for each other. And they, the receptionist was saying today, not her fault, I'm not blaming anybody.
Yeah, I know that, I know.
Saying that... it's not looking like she'll be able to get it with him because she's not over 85, but she's Parkinson's. So I'm at a loss here, and I just don't know what to do.
Now, the only thing I heard, Marianne, sorry, and you would have heard as well, that if there are any no-shows, if there's vaccines left over at the end of the day, the GP has the authority under the HSE protocols to give the vaccine to the spouses of people they have already vaccinated, to give it to their spouses if their spouses are over 70.
Now, I didn't know that.
So it's really important. Well, hopefully you get a date very soon. And,
and
given by the amount of work yourself and your dad are doing on this, it's really important that you tell the GP that we are available at short notice if there's a no-show, because the woman, your father's partner, wife, and the woman he's caring for so lovingly, she's over 70. So if there was a vaccine left over at 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock, please let us know and we'll be straight down.
I did say,
and that's totally within the protocols. I'm not skipping any queue.
Yeah, because I did say to my father yesterday, like I live a good bit away from them, but I said, don't care what it was, what time, I'll come in. And because he's terrified to drive, he's terrified to do anything. They're just prisoners. But I know there's other people going through just as much as me. But I just needed to say this. And thanks for taking the call.
Okay. They sound like two remarkable people.
Yeah, they are. You've no idea.
They really do.
Thanks.
Tell him. And he's holding firm for so long now.
Yeah. And they've just gone through the mail. My mother, she was in hospital 2 weeks ago. I was a day patient. She had to get 5 cancer growths taken off her face. And it's just a nightmare. And this, all he keeps talking about is the vaccine, the vaccine. It's like their lifeline, you know. But listen, Joe, thanks for taking contact with other people.
Marianne, well, and that's what's really important to give yourself and those other people before the break a platform to try and hopefully the powers that be. I know they're to the pin of their collar, but I know there's a meeting of the EU heads this afternoon, all the leaders, and I presume people will start communicating to... the European Commission that they're asleep at the wheel. They missed out on another contract. Boris Johnson swooped in again this morning. Anyway, Marianne O'Brien,
kind regards to you
and your family. Back, Joe at RT.ie, back to this incredible case, which we covered at great length on Tuesday's programme. Keith Flynn, Lindsay Clark, 2 solicitors, 60 false IDs. 8, they preyed on 8 homeless people and bought their PPS numbers. That was, as Noel Baker pointed out, that was the garden where all their other fraud flourished from, those PPS numbers they robbed or they bought from homeless individuals. 80 bank accounts, robbed 400 grand. Again, you see, the argument is, isn't it? Oh, it's a victimless crime. They ripped off the banks. 40 driving licenses, 20 fake. I don't know how you can get 20 real driving licenses. How do you get them? 19 ATM cards, 16 credit union cards. He got 4 years and she got 2 years. And the number of people are pointing out, not only did he get one of the pleas of mitigation that was mentioned in the examiner that was put to the judge for him, is that he had done a course in Ballymaloe. 12 grand, by the way, if you want to do a course in Ballymaloe. I wonder, did he rob that money? 12 grand to do the course in Ballymaloe, and therefore he should get it. He's working in the staff canteen in whichever prison he's in. But Alice Leahy, Alice of Trust and a homeless campaigner for more years than we can remember between us, Alice, at this stage. But Alice, you've latched on to the homeless, the way they preyed on the homeless. Why do you think that was so shocking?
Well, Joe, it was absolutely shocking. I think here you had two well-educated people in a position of power, and they're using the PPS numbers of people who are homeless. Now, for the people who are homeless, well, for everyone, we all have our PPS number.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who are homeless, many of them, it's the only possession they have. And the other thing, too, is for many of them to get even a basic service, they have to produce their PPS number.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Well, yeah, well, and we, people are very surprised when they come in to us, because we do ask people, you know, and particularly now with COVID, well, we've always asked people for their name and where they've come from and where they slept the previous night to make sure that we can just meet their needs. And they're very surprised when we don't ask them for their PPS number. But then they sometimes come to us to know, do we write a letter to get a service? It might be able to, if they're trying to get accommodation or whatever, and they're very surprised when we say, you know, we don't keep your PPS number, because we don't keep any personal information on people. But then for some of the people we would meet, people think that all homeless people are they label them, and many of the people we meet who are extremely honest and won't even go to get the service they're entitled to or look for the money they're entitled to. But many, then, when they go to get something, they're judged because they're homeless, and they're seen as not being trustworthy or that, which is absolutely appalling. So then, if they've lost their PPS number, are they going to be believed? And many wouldn't like going to the Garda station either, because some of them may have had their own difficulties with the guards in the past. So you have all of that. And we're hearing about the victims being the banks and the different people. Mind you, I must say there's credit due to the men in the Bank of Ireland for detecting it. But these poor homeless people, it is shocking that they should do that. And, you know, then we hear about the chef who will go into prison, whereas if people who are homeless, we meet, they go into
prison. Well, I don't know. I don't know if he's a chef. I don't know what his validated qualifications are. Apparently, as Barrs has said, he did Ballymanoo, which I'm sure is fantastic. But to do Ballymanoo, you need 12 grand. And
you
I'm sure there's tests at the end, but I don't know if Ballymanoo was recognised by the College of Catering, the way they're validated. I'm sure it's very reliable. But anyway, but the main thing you need to get into Ballymaloo is 12 grand. Now, well, maybe he used the PPS number.
And 12 grand is a lot of money, Joe.
But back to your point, Alice, that you say the PPS, they bought the PPS numbers off 8 people who were homeless. That PPS number is their, as you say, their most valuable possession. For example, when I go, if I'm homeless, Alice, and I'm due to get the vaccine, do I give my PPS number?
Well, we haven't had any, we haven't been sending anyone to get the vaccine, but I understand from people I have met who are working in the services that they have to give their PPS number.
And remember, the other thing as well is, given the number of accounts that Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark opened using these 8 genuine PPS numbers, which they bought for 100 quid each, Alice, 100 quid each of people who were on the streets, given the number of bank accounts, those PPS numbers are now attached to so many fraudulent bank accounts that I presume those PPS numbers, I just hope those 8 individuals don't have been given new numbers, because in the future, please God, people get on their feet and be lucky enough to maybe be able to apply for a loan to get a start in life or whatever.
Joe,
when they give their PPS number,
the
bank could say, hang on a minute, that PPS number was part of a fraud that ripped us of 400 grand. We only got 100 grand back, by the way. 300 grand is still missing.
Right. And I wonder, is there anyone looking after the people? Or are these people ashamed to maybe go forward and say their number? They had sold their numbers, because they are probably very vulnerable people, you know, who would need a lot of support and encouragement. And they really do need to be found and to be helped.
They spent work it out,
Alice. You'd wonder about the role of the banks in doing that.
Well, these two, Flynn and Clark, their husband and wife, he got 4 years. Both of them admitted that they were co-conspirators. Neither blamed the other. But he got 4 and she got 2, because apparently she gave mitigating circumstances in court the other day, which we're not allowed to talk about at this stage. Maybe we will be. They spent 800 quid on the 8, buying the 8 PPS numbers, and they stole at least 400 grand. for an 800 grand investment.
Isn't it? And you'd wonder if that is just the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, where did they meet those people? Were they people who went looking for legal aid, or did they pick them out on the streets? I think a good bit of investigative journalism is required to get the whole story here.
Well, the Irish Examiner are leading the charge on that now, Baker. And
it's true. And they have been very good in the Examiner, highlighting that issue. Of course, it did happen down in Cork. But, you know, and 100 euro for a PPS number, that could be somebody who had an alcohol problem or a drug problem. Yeah. And getting 100 euro if you are crying cash. Out for a drink is an awful lot of... it's very little for the people who bought it. But there is something very wrong about this. I think it was really a very new low, isn't it?
You've said it, Alice, I think. John Lonergan, John, former governor at Mountjoy. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
The first question our listeners asked the other day was, how come this guy, Keith Flynn, one of his mitigation pleas, according to the Examiner, by his barrister in court the other day, was he's been in custody since October. She was released on bail since October. And... was in court on Monday. But one of the pleas for mitigation was that he was now cooking for the staff in the prison. How would you know, and I know, well, maybe you don't agree. From my years in the probation service and interaction with the prison service, one of the best jobs in the prison you can get is in the kitchens, as you know. How did he get the job so quickly?
Well, I mean, I think there's two elements to it, Joe. I'm one of those who have always fought against this idea of continuing on punishment and vindictiveness against people who are convicted in the courts. I believe that the court's job is to sentence based on the evidence before them. And once the judge and a jury, first of all, or whoever it was, or whether they pleaded guilty, once they were guilty of something and then they were sentenced, that was the punishment. And then they went to prison, and the job of the prison then is to ensure that sentence is carried out. And there's no further punishment element attached to it.
So you
and
just...
going into prison with backgrounds like him would be very few and far between. It was my experience. So if he or she or any other person going into prison had any sort of a particular skill or gift or whatever it is, experience, that obviously it would be regarded as a premium gift if you have any cooking or catering skills in a prison. And it is normal for people like that to make their way or to be brought to or introduced into places like kitchens or cafes or the prison staff mess. It would have always been the case, and that it would have nothing got to do with the fact that he was what crimes he had committed. It was more got to do with whatever skills he had to enable the prison to function.
Okay.
To the function of the prison.
Okay, so from the court case, we don't know anything else, and that's what we're going on. Maybe there is third level from the well-regarded, not well-regarded, it's verified, validated external examiners in the College of Catering, which is part of DIT in Dublin. But the claim was he did a course in Ballymaloe. So you're saying the governor would look at that, or the prison bosses would look at that, or the department would say, okay, he did a course in Ballymaloe, well, that's very good. And no one would say, hang on a minute, it's 12 grand to do the course in Ballymaloe. Did he rob that money? Second part of the question. And no one would say, well, can we write to Ballymaloe and say, did he do exams or did he pass exams or did he poison anybody? He's a con man. He can't be trusted. He preyed on homeless people. He had 60 false identities. He robbed 400 grand from the banks. He had 21 genuine driving licenses. He had eight genuine PPS numbers. How can we trust this guy in a kitchen?
Well, you know... You're saying you
don't see that?
No, well, I think, Joe, he is in prison. I mean, people forget that. He is in prison. His reputation is absolutely shattered and gone. And that's the biggest penalty. And he's now in prison. So all those factors are all factors that would be legitimate factors to take into account before he was sentenced. In prison, in the context of somebody who would be have a skill to provide some service in the prison, those sorts of skills and others as well, like people with trades, and there would be a minority and a tiny minority of people going into prison. Most people going into prison actually don't have any skills or abilities.
But Alice,
they would be regarded as premium skills.
And they don't, well, they don't, most people going into prison, John, as well, which you've always pointed out, one would not be in the age group these two are in. They're in their 30s and 40s, first time in prison. And two wouldn't be from the so-called upstanding background these two are from. But are you saying, John, he's a qualified solicitor? Would he be allowed to give free legal aid? And Alice made the
I'm sure he may in some cases give unofficial advice maybe over the during his time in prison. But I mean, he's been struck off as a solicitor. But I suppose that the point I'd be making, and the only point I want to make, is that the only way the prison system itself can operate fairly is to be non-judgmental. You cannot be judging individual people going into prison, because every single one of them has some particular blemish. Blemishes in their character.
But you're saying you do judge them on the qualifications they say they have.
I don't say they're judged on that. They're assigned work on the basis of a skill they have. And if he hasn't got that skill or ability, well, that will come to light very quickly.
Okay. I take that point. If he's not able to boil an egg, it'll be spoiled.
Is not to further punish people.
Okay,
I
take that's a very strong point. And if people think the sentence, which a lot of people do, think the sentence of 4 years for him and 2 years for her is too lenient, they can make that.
As some of your listeners mightn't know, the Director of Public Prosecution has the power to appeal that decision on the basis of leniency, on behalf of the people. And if
John,
the DPP believes that, well, then that can be appealed.
Just tell us why the job in the kitchens, especially as a chef, is so sought after, John.
Well, for all sorts of reasons. It's not the only job. I mean, some prisoners, by the way, would never go near the kitchen. But some prisoners would like it. First of all, they're usually unlocked longer. So they could be up from 7 o'clock in the morning to maybe 8 o'clock at night. So they'd be out of cell a lot longer. Yeah. Obviously, the freedom of working in the kitchen would be better than standing around on a landing. And of course, they have the perks of the food and that. Yeah. So there's a lot of positives. And if you're working in the kitchen, you certainly are in the library or in the bakery or in the different activities in the prison. There's certainly amount during my time. Anybody that was working on those jobs had a sort of a built up a very credible record, and they often benefited from that then and maybe been transferred to an open centre or whatever.
And that's the job of his counsel the other day. The guy hadn't even been sentenced, and he was looking for mitigation on the basis that he was working in he was doing such a good job in the kitchens for the prison staff, for the canteen, for the prison. But John, isn't there another element of working in the kitchen, and that is you can come across delicacies and that stuff that might be in demand by other prisoners that you might be able to barter for cigarettes or a mobile phone or some drink?
Well, nowadays, I think people may, that man was on remand for quite a while, so he wasn't.
Well, don't go too soft. He's on remand since October, John.
Yeah, so
he rocked up to court. That photograph that everyone's looking at, he rocked up to court in his short sleeve shirt, a pair of jeans, his mobile phone in his pocket. She was even more casually, which they're entitled to do. But he didn't show much respect for the court as he rocked in that day. But anyway, he's been in prison for 3 months and he's already got one of the best jobs in the prison. But as you say, the job of the prison staff is not to judge him again. It's to look at what he's offering and what is available. And as you say, his age, his qualifications, his Ballymaloe course, I'll stand to him. Alice, sorry, you want to come in there,
Joe, I'm listening with great interest, because like everybody else, yourself included, we would all say that being in prison curtails your freedom, and that is punishment. But the reality is there are 8 people out there who are homeless, and if they end up in prison, they certainly aren't, they won't be treated, they'll be treated the same as everybody else, but the life's opportunities they've had to date and are likely to have in the future are very limited. And I don't know, was it John or was it you said, you know, I think it was John, that not many people from that type of background would end up in prison. Well, the reality is they don't end up in prison, many people from backgrounds like that, because they can afford to have the best solicitors in the land, the best of legal aid, and people to speak up for them. But for many of the people who are homeless, and the people like those people who were desperately exploited, they very often have nobody to speak up for them. And I think that is the reality. And I hope somebody will go to their aid and see, because they're obviously people who are probably ashamed that they allowed this to happen, and are probably maybe full of anger that their position was exploited.
John, he won't be cooking food for the homeless people if any of them, God forbid, ended up in prison. He won't be cooking food for that. His food is not good enough for them, though the food is very good overall, John, I take that point. But he's cooking food for the prison staff.
Yeah.
That's
just
a cheap point by me.
That's what I understand. I only understand that. But I mean, he would also be cooking for the prisoners. I suppose the point I'd make, and there's nobody I admire more than Alice Leahy, and I'm an absolute legend. And of course, she's dead right in relation to having a vice for the homeless. The crimes they committed, the exploitation of the homeless, was despicable. So there's no softness on my part in relation to the crimes those two people committed. My argument always was, and I put this into practice as much as possible, once they came in the gate of the prison door, judgment by the prison staff and by prison authorities should cease.
Okay, I take that point very strongly.
Yeah, otherwise, where do you start, draw the line if you don't do that?
And John, just in terms of conditions, again, I know, well, we can't talk about individuals. They're criminals. We can talk about them. They are criminals. She goes to a women's prison. She got 2 years. She'd be out probably for Christmas, will she?
Unlikely, I say unlikely, because of the high profile. I mean, that'll be very much a political decision if she's released or just released before her time is up. But I doubt very much if she qualifies.
But she's
for
2 years. Well, 2 years.
She'd be normally 18 months, so you'd be talking about September, October of next year before her sentence would end. So she certainly wouldn't, in my opinion, be eligible for parole at Christmas.
Okay. It doesn't apply to this case. But John, I think I know the answer because of my years there. If I have if a woman has a baby in prison, am I allowed to keep the baby? This is not this case I'm talking about. Just make that clear. But is a woman allowed, given I'd have you on, is a woman allowed to keep a baby if the baby is born in prison?
Yeah, she is. Yeah, okay. Or indeed, if she's she has a baby on the outside and was, for instance, breastfeeding the baby, she couldn't bring the baby to prison with her if she'd been committed after the birth. And if the birth happens while she's serving a sentence, yes, she can keep the baby up to about a year.
Well, that's right.
The baby then has to be handed over either to a family relative or the health board would have to intervene.
Yeah,
because prison isn't an appropriate place for a baby after a year.
Yeah.
Because they become very.
And would there be many in your day? Again, this is I'm going as per usual. I'm going off on a different point. But in your day, John, and I know you were pioneering in terms of DOCUS and the treatment of women in a humanitarian and treatment of everyone in a humanitarian way. But in your day, would there be many women that would want to hold on to their children in prison?
Yeah, we had always, on a regular basis, we often had one or two or three babies in the prison. At one time and at the same time, although it was a bit unusual in the old days, Joe, some people would say it, in the old days babies were never, except the woman was on remand, the mother was always released when she had a baby, and so the policy was not to have babies in prison at all, but that changed in the late 90s and I'm sure it is still a regular feature of prison today that mothers bring babies with them or have the babies while they're in prison, and the baby stays there for up to 12 months or so.
By the way, do you earn extra money when you're working in the kitchen?
There's an enhanced gratuity scheme in place for the last number of years.
He'll probably come out, Flynn will probably, Keith Flynn will probably come out richer than when he, well, he's 300 grand, grand
like
stashed somewhere.
Euro a week.
Yeah. They found 100 grand in this site. By the way, John, you see, the other thing that people point out, neither of them shopped each other. But the one didn't say, well, it was his idea or it was her idea. They both were co-conspirators.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
But for that, and how come he... But how come a husband and wife, and as we know from history, to have a couple, a man and a woman, engaged in crime is a pretty hard crew to catch, and they can get, as we say, persuade homeless people to sell them their PPS numbers for 100 quid. But he got 4 years and she got 2 years, but both of them say we did as much as each other.
I'm sure the judge had some reason for doing that. As you said already,
okay.
There were some
William,
reasons
okay.
to them. There could be health reasons. There could be all sorts of reasons.
Okay. I'm so long over now. Are there still trustees in prison, John?
Very, very few. Very, very few. Because of the drug culture and all the consequences of the drug culture.
Well, in my day, it was long-term prisoners who would be regarded as having a good track record, and they'd be given extra responsibilities. William is a former prisoner. William, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. You're listening to this. Go ahead. He's working as a chef in the officer's mess in prison.
Right. Well, I understood. It's Cork prison, I believe he's in, is it?
I don't know which prison, but he's from Cork, so there's every possibility.
Well, in Mountjoy, the officer's mess is outside the walls.
Well, that's true, yeah.
And you can wander off up the North Circle around if you feel like it. But I've never seen anyone getting a job in the kitchen or anywhere else when you're a remand prisoner. It doesn't happen.
That's right. He was on remand up to Monday. You're right.
Yeah. Until they don't get a job.
Is that true, John? John, can you give me a job when I'm on remand?
Yeah, you can if you want to, yeah. But, very few, certainly in my time in Mountjoy, when we had remand prisoners, some of them did work, but the vast majority didn't. But if he was on remand in the current time, I'm assuming he was in Clover Hill prison, where they have remand prisoners exclusively almost, with a few sentenced prisoners for work parties and that. So in terms of whether or not a person is selected for work, it is a matter of discretion for the prison staff. Naturally enough, that's assuming that there's work available. But background and skill-wise, there's a whole lot of factors that are taken into account.
I take that point.
He's been looked after. He's been well looked after. He's after walking into the cushiest job in the jail. He's not even sentenced that he's in the cushiest job in the jail. If you're off the Shelton Abbey now in 6 or 7 weeks, on the pig's back...
Joe, I wonder, are the 8 people, the PPS numbers were taken from, are they even able to get a bed for the night? Are they sleeping out on the banks of the Lee?
William, how is that such a difficult job to get as the cooking in for the prison staff? The officer's mess, as you call it.
The officer's mess, that's nothing to do with the kitchen, Joe. That's out of the officer's mess. You wear your own clothes. There's no handcuffs. It's outside the grounds of the jail.
You're trusted.
Trusted, yeah. And you're not even sentenced.
He was sentenced on Monday to 4 years.
I've never seen it in my life.
Joe, just one other point now. You're assuming that it is in the miss in Mountjoy, which is outside the gate.
Okay, I don't know about Cork. Maybe
in other prisons inside the gate.
But William's point still stands. It is one of the best jobs. He got it while he was on remand. Now, remember, William, when they rocked up to court in their short sleeves back in October, the two of them, they were pleading guilty.
Pleading guilty? What's that got to do with it? Is the Criminal Assets Bureau going to look at them?
I presume they will. That's a good point. You're saying they're pleading guilty, but there might be other more serious charges down the road.
Where's the other 300 grand?
Okay.
Has he got a house that he can take off of, you know?
And how long, William, do you mind me asking, how long were you in prison over the years?
20 years. I've done 20 years in jail.
And did you ever get a job or responsibility?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I'm sorry for laughing. I just can't believe this.
And by the way, if you work in the kitchen, William, if someone walks in the kitchen, can you say to them, listen, I'd love... Now, don't laugh. Sorry, and I know how serious things are, but can you say to them, listen, I'd love strawberries. Can you get me a few strawberries and I'll give you a few smokes?
Well, where would you get strawberries in jail?
Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe in the officer's mess.
You might get a half a tin of tinned peaches now, all right.
Yeah, okay.
But if you had a friend working in the kitchen, he'd probably be out to get you a rasher sandwich every month, you know.
Yeah. And William, can I go again and ask you about, which is the point that Alice Leahy, as we say to him, she lit on this issue about preying on homeless people more than anything else. How did you manage over the years?
Well, I was in every institution and reform school. God, I was on the streets at 14 years of age. But I met a girl a few years ago after coming out of jail and had a few kids. We were living down in Wexford and I love it.
Brilliant. Well done, William.
But you were being released from jail with nothing in your pocket. Absolutely nothing in your pocket. So where do you go? Same thing, same.
And you say you had no qualifications. Well, this fella had a he did a course. It was 12 grand in Ballymaloe.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it? Yeah. 12 grand, yeah.
Probably Gordon Ramsay
doesn't charge that. Well, 12 grand for a cookery course.
I know, it's a well-respected cookery course, but that's what his solicitor said he did. But you can't do it. You can't get a scholarship to it. Like, you can't get. But anyway, and it's well-respected. William, stay safe, William.
And yourself too. Tell John Lonigan I was asking for
him. We'll say hello to him there across the airway.
How
John.
You
okay. Did
Hi.
Was John the boss when you were in one of the prisons, William?
John was the main man.
He was, yeah.
He was always a gentleman, though.
But I know he has a reputation for being, rightly so, as Alice has, of being a humanitarian. But you see, you could get nothing past John.
Oh, no, he's as cute as a fox.
You don't
get that job for being an idiot.
All the lads always, if a new fella came into Mountjoy and he would have seen John Lanigan on Primetime, whatever, previously, I'll go in and I'll soft soap John Lanigan. I'll be over here on Tuesday week. Well, they went into the wrong man if they were telling lies.
At the end of John's career, there was an old saying going around jail, the only time you get to see the governor now is on the Late Late Show.
John, what are you doing in your retirement?
Oh, very little at the moment, Joe, next to like everybody else.
Okay.
The coronavirus pandemic hit us, I was busy enough going to schools and colleges and voluntary groups and quite a lot of different activities like that. And hopefully this will be back to normal again come the end of the summer.
Maybe you do a course in Ballymaloe, William is saying. I just want to make the point, John, that since this was mentioned on Liveline on Tuesday and people went through the article in The Examiner by Noel Baker, and I was off yesterday, but I haven't heard people being so savagely indignant about these two and them preying on homeless people and their false bank accounts and robbing or buying their PPS numbers and their 21 drive. They don't know how they got 21 driving licenses and their 16 ATM cards and their 80 bank accounts and their false passports and their false electricity bills they were used to get these. Now, people are... Now, they're up in arms over the sentence, but that's only... We can all talk about that, but it was the judge who heard everything, and the judge is a highly respected judge. But, John, I cannot explain to you how angry people are over this. I know they didn't... What's the line? You didn't kill anyone and you didn't... It's a victimless crime, just robbing the banks and people. But people are very, very annoyed about the homeless aspect of it. People are very annoyed about the way they swaggered up to court. People are very annoyed about the sentence they got. People are very annoyed about the cushy job he got immediately, as William pointed out, while he was on remand. People are very annoyed that he got 4 years. The maximum was 8. And for the same crime, she got 2 years. People are... And by the way, I know, your point was earlier, she won't get out early, she won't get out this side of Christmas because it's so high profile. But John, as you know, and I know from this programme, it's the victims that watch to see when the relatives of victims that watch to see, they're the ones that contact this programme, say, I heard the man who, God forbid, murdered my daughter, he got two temporary release or he's been moved to an open prison. But in this case, John, with Flynn and Clark, there's no victims. So the banks won't be ringing Liveline in December saying she's getting out, because as the judge pointed out, with the exception of the Bank of Ireland, all the other institutions weren't bothered. They didn't even treat it as fraud until this incredible man in the Bank of Ireland spotted the fraud. So there won't be anyone tracking these two, John. And I know they were,
I have a little bit more faith in the system than that. I believe that the system is relatively impartial and objective in relation to the release of people. There's always a political dimension to some crimes and not to other crimes. And this is one where now there's a high media interest and a high political thing. The only other observation I'd make about the reaction of the public, that has not changed over the last 40 years or 50 years since I was involved. Mm. There's always a reaction by the public to certain things.
I disagree with you there, John. There's always a reaction to from the public when crimes involve violence. There is always a reaction. There is seldom a reaction when it involves fraud and two solicitors on the level that we're getting now to these two. The collusion, the homeless, preying on homeless people, all the false IDs, all the real IDs, all the identifications, all the false bank accounts, all the real driving, 20 real drive. How do you get 20 driving licenses? They hardly did 20 tests under 20 different names. I know, but this one is different. There's no violence involved, yet people are really angry about it.
They are in prison.
Yeah. I know.
They have been sentenced. They have been convicted. Their reputations are gone. I don't know how much the public need in terms of revenge.
I don't think it's revenge, John. I think it's
people. Well, I'd say there's a huge amount of revenge in it. Because why else would people be so vindictive about what the person is doing in prison? They're already in prison, so they have a prison record. You can't go any lower, Joe, than when you end up in prison. That's the lowest level in terms of social status. So I personally have never felt any sort of satisfaction out of people in prison getting further punishment or whatever it is. They're already sentenced and their reputations have already been taken from them. Rightly so, by the way. Yeah, it's not having any sympathy. They exploited people.
But John, nobody, I'm taking exception to your use of the word revenge in our listeners. Nobody is arguing that this fella or whore should be put in stocks and we should throw rotten vegetables at them in the courtyard of Cork or Mountjoy Prison. What they're complaining about is that your man got the cushy job so quickly. That's the thing.
A cushy job in prison. I'm going to say that is number one I've ever heard anyway.
Well, it's one of the cushy.
For me, there's no such thing as a cushy job in prison. Once you go to prison, that's it.
Okay.
That's my experience as well, not just my opinion.
Alice,
Joe,
your point.
I too would take exception to the word revenge. I have spent a lot of my time working in the prison. I was on the sentence review group and I used to visit all the prisons, and I've met a number of homeless people who would be dying to get back into prison because very often it's the only place they can get a bed. But I think the reason people are very annoyed about this is we're living in very strange times. We're seeing people sleeping on streets, in doorways, people who can't get accommodation, and people who are trying to get accommodation for them and working very hard. And then you have people in society who are of a certain status, and look at what they did to these people who are homeless. And people do feel very strongly about it. I know my colleagues at work, they were on to me about it. They were very upset by it. And, I think it raises a lot of issues. Now, I'm not in favour of punishing people any more than they have been, the punishment that has been meted out to them. But I do think it has raised a number of issues. And I think we're inclined to always see the homeless person as somebody who's no good to do anything, who's in and out of prison, who's in and out of psychiatric hospitals, or can't get a bed. This is the absolute opposite to that. It is where the lives of these poor people, where they've been exploited, they've been robbed, and they probably now are ashamed to even admit that it happened to them.
And remember, if these two had not been caught...
No.
If these two had not been caught...
Only for that very... I hope that man in the Bank of Ireland, I was just saying to my husband the other night when I heard it, I said, I hope that man gets promotion because he was very alert.
But another very well-respected journalist, I won't name him at this stage, but he's listening and he's saying, Had these two not been caught, it would have been extremely difficult for any former homeless person with a background in addiction and possibly with a criminal record for small offences to convince a financial institution in the future that they had not been responsible for defaulting on a loan taken out in their name. It may yet throw up difficulties if their names have been put on a bank watch list.
That's right.
Okay. We leave it at that. Alice Leahy, good to meet you, Margaret Trust. John Donegan, as always, fascinating to hear from you and your point of view. John Donegan, former governor of Mountjoy. 51551, watch out.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
I didn't say a proper thank you also to William, who, as he said, has been in prison for a total of 20 years since he was in and out of institutions, he said, as a young boy. And he's now happily married and a family, brilliant, down in Wexford. Thanks again, William. I should also point out the programme Children of the Troubles, myself and Freya McClemens made about the children killed in the conflict in Northern Ireland, 186 of them, was broadcast last night on RTE. Now, not many people knew about it, but that's neither here nor there because it was a repeat, I'm told. That's the reason they didn't promote it. But it's up on the RTE player if people want to see it. It's called Children of the Troubled. I've obviously seen it numerous times, but for some reason, and that was the reaction I got from so many people last night and this morning, for some reason at this time, people were deeply affected by the stories told in that. It's up on the RTE player. Tom Maloney, I was listening to Katie yesterday talking to Susan Lawler about her incredible brother Martin, the former psychiatrist who was the victim of a hit and run fatality and the awful, awful circumstances. And Susan was so powerful. Tom Maloney, Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Joe.
It's 1995. What happened?
Yes, it was the 16th of August, 1995, Joe. Yeah. And it was about 100 yards from our home, between the church and the school. There were some roadworks going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was Alan. Alan was playing around with people around. You know, with machinery, children are trying to go over.
Yeah, of course. Machinery. Yeah.
Yeah, so they were hanging around there and with girls and so forth and so on, Joe. And a jeep came up the road with bull bars, and it hit Alan was trying to cross the road. And he hit Alan, when he hit him, there was an articulated lorry parked across the road,
mm-hmm.
because it was doing work, and he landed right underneath that lorry, and he was trapped,
yeah.
And they got him out anyway. They got out. But people came fairly fast, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't there. No, I was on my way back from London, and I didn't. That happened at around 7:10 on the 16th of August. But it was a very fine day, Joe. It was a lovely weather.
Okay.
The weather was beautiful. The sun was shining, and it was at 20 odd degrees. And 22 degrees, whatever. And my wife went. We came to the. We came up to. It was just came up the road.
Mm.
And my younger son Mark, he was 8-6 at the time. He was with him, and he seen the whole lot. And then the ambulance was called, Joe, and he was brought to the University Hospital of Limerick, which was the region at the time.
Mm.
And he never really gained conscience, Joe, but he was anointed outside. He was supposed to go into the confirmation class that September, and he was flown in by helicopter from the university up to Beaumont Hospital in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Which we arrived up on the 17th, which is the early hours of the morning, and I didn't get much hope, Joe, for him by the doctor. The doctor told me the injuries that Alan has, you might get one out of 100 might survive it, he said. And I'm a great man of prayer, so mm-hmm. I said Alan could be the one. But he died on the 22nd of August, 1995, the early hours in the morning.
Yeah.
So God, we were.
Why in Ireland does any Jeep need bull bars?
I don't know, Joe. I actually questioned that, and what really, really got to me, it wasn't really the bull bars after, Joe, yeah. But what really got to me was the driver taking off at a speed, Joe, and leaving his broken body, for the better word, underneath that particular 11 years of age. And to lose a child, Joe, it's very, very, very hard altogether. Because you expect to grow before them yourself. Yeah. Well, I do, and you expect to grow before my own children. And then to see him being when I arrived in the University Hospital, it was really heartbroken. I just can't get my head around it. Even to this very day, how a person could knock someone down. Mm. Even if I knocked a dog down or a cat, I'd put up just to drive off. I think that was the hardest part of it, Joe, I think.
And he was caught, the driver?
He presented himself two days later, Joe, to a Garda station. He was outside Limerick, and he was subsequently going to be charged with dangerous driving, causing death. But we had a lot of young people now. It was about 9 young people that was there. It was girls and boys. They were all under the age of 10. They presented themselves in court, but the judge wouldn't accept them. He didn't want to hear evidence from them. So it was drafted careless driving.
And Tom, did you ever see the Jeep? You saw the driver, I hope, but did you ever see the Jeep that killed your child with the bull bars?
I did, Joe, and it's funny that you say that, Joe, because the very Jeep that knocked Alan down, that was drove down to the very courthouse in Limerick District Court by the same man.
He drove the Jeep with the bull bars to court.
Right down to the court in at the car park, and I was parked not too far up, and there Kathleen just put her head down, and I said, "What?" And because it was my first time seeing the death is there. She knew the registration of it now, you know. So there it was. I couldn't understand that either, Joe.
And did he walk away? Did he drive away? Did he get a sentence?
He got no sentence, Joe, and he got no. I was going to say penalty points. It wasn't penalty points at the time. He got no fine, and he was put off the road. And the judge really said nothing.
Okay. I'm so sorry. And Mark, so Alan would be what, in his 30s now?
Alan would be 30s, I think he's 36 or 37, Joe.
And Mark, how's Mark doing?
He's not doing too good at times, Joe. You know, we got a lot of counselling and a lot of help for him. Every member of the family, especially Mark, because he's seen the whole lot. And he's doing okay, Joe. He's fine. He's in a relationship with a girl and they have two children.
Okay. And I know you lost another son. In was that an accident as well, Thomas? You tell us.
Yeah, Thomas was 7 years later, Joe. I didn't realise I was going to be visiting Bowman Hospital again.
Yeah.
Thomas was in Dublin for the day on the 21st of April, 2002, and he missed the train down from Euston Station, and he walked down towards the petrol station late at night, Joe, because we was after ringing him and told me that he was going to book in to a B&B and I'd see me tomorrow. And I was kind of happy enough with that because he had money and everything, Joe. So he was queued up at that petrol station, Joe, waiting to get some cigarettes. And some guy said something to him about Limerick. And he said something about Dublin. And it went down to that, Joe. That was taught in court. And he hit him. And then another fella got involved. And they knocked him to the ground. And his head was beaten off of the curb. Right off the curb was beaten, Joe. The CCTV is very, very clear of Thomas. I'd love to get the CCTV, Joe, of Thomas She was Kevin Street Garda Station, were good, they were brilliant guards. Okay. Garda Gable or Garda, I can't forget him. He was the man, was there. And he was so good, you know. He was at the hospital most of the time, Joe. And Thomas died in the intensive care unit, the same unit as Alan died on the 3rd of May. The 3rd of May 2002, Joe.
So you've lost two boys. The
thing about Alan was, Joe, the good thing that we had to make is a decision about his organs being donated.
Okay.
And we donated his organs.
There was
a child in his arms on my mind because I guess a letter every year, every Christmas, in England, in Great Ormond Street, London. His heart was kept to her, and she's doing very well.
Yeah.
Up to now, I believe.
And Tom, I know you campaigned on to get speed ramps.
Yes, Joe.
That was successful.
The traffic calming measures at the time, and the late Jim Kimmy, he was mayor of Limerick, and I went to him with Kathleen, the two of us, and we sat in the office with him, and I was crying, and so was Kathleen almost.
Yeah.
And he said to me, "Look, I'll see what I can do." Okay. I didn't want to see anyone else go through the same as I was going through, Joe, because it was a kind of a speed road, you know. And,
I take well done on that, and it's a terrible tragedy, two tragedies to befall your family. But I am baffled by bull bars. I was looking at them on the Jeep yesterday. What are they? They're an affectation. We don't have kangaroos bouncing across the M50.
Most of the Jeeps, I have a Jeep myself, and there's no bull bars in it. I was sure. Well, when I was getting it, it was all the Jeeps had no bull bars, and I think someone campaigned about bull bars may not be on Jeeps.
No, they're legal in Ireland once they're proper bull bars. Would you believe that? Once they're proper bull bars. Oh my God! Tom, you get a letter every year from the child who got. Oh, that's incredible.
I do, Joe, and she's doing very well at the moment.
Okay.
She made her communion and she made her confirmation and so
well
on.
Well done.
She was four years of age and weighing on a heart. And I believe if she didn't get the heart by Christmas, Lord knows what that happened.
Okay. Well done, Tom. She got a big heart from your gorgeous boy who was only 11. Tom, kind regards and thinking of you and your family. That's Tom.
Thanks very much, Joe.
You look after yourself. God bless you too.
God bless.
God bless you.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Joe at RT.ie. Marie Nepper, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Marie.
Okay, good. It's where are we? It's Raheny in Dublin. Where did you find this bracelet?
I found the bracelet in Raheny in Dublin. It was found about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And over the 2 years, I have shared on Facebook, lost and found pages on...
Everywhere. Okay, you haven't told us. Tell us about the bracelet.
The bracelet is silver. Yeah. It's a heart and like an inverted, two inverted hearts. And on the inside, there's an inscription from Hamlet.
Yeah, Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, I tell you the inscription?
I do, yeah. Off you go. Do it in your best Shakespearean Kate Winslet accent and performance. No. When you're ready, take your time.
It says, "Doubt that the sun don't move.
Yeah.
Doubt that the stars aren't fire. Doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love."
That's lovely. I bet you performed that brilliant, Mary. Are you involved in amateur dramatics out on the north side? Come on, tell me the truth.
Honest to God, no.
And you're not as good as this fella. This is Kenneth Branagh doing the same lines. He's brutal.
Doubt thou the stars are fire? Doubt the sun doth move? Doubt truth to be a liar? But never doubt I love.
He's brutal. Now, that's Kenneth Branagh. So is there anything else on the... We haven't a hope, Mary. Is there anything else on the bracelet?
Nothing. And I've shared it, like I said, all over social media. But when I read the inscription, I kind of said to myself, this has to be of great sentimental value to somebody. So I've been trying on and off, and sometimes I forget it's still in my possession. And
would you
I
not wear it? Would you wear it yourself?
No, I don't think so. I'd love to.
Why
just,
not?
I just love to get it back to whoever owns it.
But is there anyone in your life that you'd love to give a bracelet with this quote on it, with Kenneth Branagh on
Doubt
it?
Doubt thou the stars are fire. Doubt the sun doth move.
Indeed.
Doubt truth to be a liar.
But never doubt.
I love.
I love. Surely, Mary, there's someone in your life.
Oh,
is there someone in your life you'd love to give it to? Don't tell them you found. It's 2 years. You keep it, will you? Is it worth anything?
I don't know. It's silver. I'd say it. I wouldn't say it's an astronomical amount. I'd say it's more sentimental value than anything else.
And where's it sitting now? Where's it sitting now?
It's sitting upstairs on top of my dresser.
Yeah, will you wear it or give it away or else give it to the Vincent de Paul or else double your house insurance now that you've told us all that you have a magnificent piece of jewellery up on your upstairs. That lovely, by the way, K-N-E-P-P-E-R.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
It's American.
Knepper.
Knepper.
Or is it Knepper?
No, it's Knepper.
Knepper. Knepper. And what were you called? UK. What were you called in school? What's the short for Knepper?
Oh, my maiden name was Brown.
Brown. Okay. Knepper Brown. Okay, yeah. Mary, we'll do our best, but I wouldn't. I'd be I'd be dipping that in Coca Cola to clean it. I'd be wearing that proudly, or else I'd be giving it away to the love in my life.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And as I say, Children of the Troubles is on the RTE player. Annette Egan produced, Gareth Duffy was in sound. Maeve Mooney, DBC on Ray Darcy next.